Welcome back to the deep dive. So if you're listening to this right now, chances are your desk is, well, it's probably buried under end-of-year compliance checklists.
Oh, absolutely. For anyone managing employee benefits, this time of year isn't just about closing out the calendar.
No, it's about juggling what's due right now for the year that's ending, and at the same time, getting all your systems programmed for the year about to start.
Exactly. And since time is the one thing no one has, our mission today is to, you know, distill all of that. We're taking what's usually a dense technical overview.
The kind you'd get from Randstad Insurance or Zywave.
Right. And we're turning it into clear, actionable knowledge. We're separating the immediate deadlines from the forward planning you need to do for 2026. What to file now and what to program later.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're going to start right at the top with the compliance item that always seems to generate the most questions. Probably this is such an intriguing name.
The gag clause attestation.
The gag clause attestation. It sounds dramatic.
It does.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely critical because it gets right to the heart of transparency. Since 2023, federal rules require health plans to annually attest that they are not using any so-called gag clauses.
So what exactly is a gag clause in this context? What are we talking about?
Well, think of it as a contractual term, maybe between a health plan and a big hospital system, that restricts the plan from sharing certain data.
Data on what?
Things like provider cost, quality of care metrics, or even de-identified claims data. The rule bans these clauses to, you know, increase price transparency for everyone.
And because this attestation covers the 2025 compliance period, the deadline is?
December 31st of this year.
Right. So this is an immediate to-do list item. Now, let's talk liability. This is where it gets tricky, right? Who is legally on the hook to file this?
It really depends on the plan type, and this is a distinction that can catch people out. If you have a fully insured plan, you can generally rely on the health insurance issuer.
So they handle it.
They handle the administrative burden, yes.
But if you're a self-insured employer, it's a different story. You can't just hand it off, can you?
You can't. And this is the crucial legal nugget. For self-insured plans, you can contract with your TPA to handle the submission process. However,
there's a but.
There is. The ultimate legal responsibility for compliance stays with the health plan itself. You can delegate the task, but you can't delegate the liability.
So you need to be actively confirming that your TPA actually did it.
You have to. You need that confirmation by the deadline.
That is a really important clarification. Okay, moving on to another critical year-end task, fund management. This is basically the use your money or lose it part of the year.
Precisely. We're talking health FSAs, HRAs, dependent care FSAs.
Mm.
This is the moment for really forceful and frequent communication with your employees.
Especially about those unspent balances that are subject to forfeiture at the end of the 2025 plan year.
Right. And there are three things the communication absolutely must contain.
What?
First, the exact deadlines for submitting claims. The runout periods. You might have until, say, March 31st to submit claims for 2025.
It's okay. That's one.
Second, if your plan has a grace period that lets people use funds in early 2026, you have to communicate those specific dates.
And third,
if you allow a carryover, which is common for health FSAs, you have to remind them of the specific cap on that carryover amount.
Get any of those wrong and you end up with frustrated employees.
And forfeited funds. Yes.
Beyond the money, there's a whole list of annual administrative confirmations that can sometimes fly under the radar.
Yes, the annual notices. Now, we all know the Medicare Part D creditable coverage notice has that hard October 15th deadline.
Right.
But others, like the CHIP notice, the Children's Health Insurance Program notice, and the WHCRA notice, they just need to be provided at some point during the year.
And just for a quick refresher, the CHIP notice is about?
It alerts employees to potential state assistance for children's health care.
Mm.
And WHCRA, the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act, that notice ensures patients know their rights to reconstructive surgery after a mastectomy.
Mandatory, but easy to overlook. And what about cleaning up the plan documents themselves?
Also mandated. If you made any discretionary changes to the plan design for 2025, maybe you added a new benefit, those official plan documents have to be formally amended by the end of this year.
The paper has to match the reality.
Exactly. And the final piece of the 2025 cleanup is non-discrimination testing.
Why is this so essential?
Well, this is all about making sure that your benefit plans, and we're talking about everything from Section 125 cafeteria plans to retirement plans, don't disproportionately favor your highly compensated employees.
Over the non-highly compensated employee.
Right. It's a required check to make sure the tax benefits are being offered broadly, which is what keeps the plans tax qualified in the first place.
So we've certified the transparency rules. We've cleaned up the 2025 paperwork. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. We're shifting from cleaning up the past to, well, building the foundation for 2026.
Exactly. This is strategic forward planning. And for applicable large employers, or ALEs, that's employers with 50 or more full-time equivalents, the big one is the ACA affordability requirement for 2026.
Getting this right is how you avoid those massive A or B penalties.
It is.
And for plan years starting in 2026, the specific affordability percentage has been set. What's the number?
It's 9.96% of the employee's household income.
9.96%. So how does that compare to 2025? Are we seeing a big climb here?
It's a very slight specific increase. The trend has been more towards stabilization, but what matters is what it means in practice.
Which is?
The lowest cost minimum value plan you offer for self-only coverage cannot cost an employee more than 9.96% of their household income.
But household income is notoriously difficult for an employer to know, which is why we have the safe harbors, right?
That's the strategic part. The IRS gives you three main safe harbors to use instead. W-2 wages, rate of pay, or the federal poverty line.
So if you're an ALE with, say, a workforce with high turnover or lots of fluctuating hours, which one tends to make the most sense?
Well, the federal poverty line safe harbor is often the simplest to administer. It's just one number for the year.
But not always the best fit.
Not always. Many sophisticated employers actually prefer the rate of pay safe harbor. It's really useful for large hourly populations because it tests affordability based on their rate of pay, not their final W-2 wages. It gives you more certainty.
And once you've locked in that core ACA policy, the last piece of forward planning is making sure employees know what's coming.
Absolutely. You have to revise your summary plan descriptions, your SPDs, or issue a summary of material modifications. You got to spell out all the changes for 2026 new costs, coverage changes, and especially all new contribution limits.
Let's get into those limits because this is where the real work for payroll and HR systems comes in. We need to get these new statutory numbers programmed correctly. And it looks like nearly all of them went up for 2026.
They did. We can start with the health savings accounts and high deductible health plans. The HSA HDHP limits, you have to look at them as a package.
Okay, so what are the new HSA contribution numbers for 2026?
For self-only coverage, the contribution limit is rising to $4,400. That's up from $4,300.
A $100 bump. And for family coverage?
That jumps from $8,550 up to $8,750. The catch-up contribution for those 55 and older, though, that stays put at $1,000.
Okay. So if the HSA contribution limits are going up, the structure of the HDHP itself has to adjust to keep pace, right? The deductibles and the out-of-pocket maximum.
They must. The HDHP minimum deductible for self-only is up to $1,700. For family, it's now $3,400.
And the out-of-pocket maximums, that's the real worst-case scenario number.
Right. For self-only, the max is now $8,500. And for family coverage, that max goes up pretty significantly from $16,600 to $17,000.
$400 increase in the family out-of-pocket max. That's a clear signal that employees need to plan on saving a bit more in their HSA just to cover that potential risk.
That's exactly the connection to make. It's not just a payroll programming task. It's a risk management communication for employees.
Let's shift to FSAs and HRAs. What are the key updates there?
The health FSA carryover limit is going up a little, from $660 to $680. But that's not the real headline.
No.
The big story, the number that needs the most urgent communication, is the dependent care FSA.
A $2,500 increase. That's huge. Give us the numbers.
Okay. The dependent care FSA limit is jumping from $5,000 all the way up to $7,500.
Wow.
And for those married filing separately, the limit goes from $2,500 up to $3,750. This isn't just a small inflation adjustment. It's a permanent structural change.
So what does that mean practically for an employer?
It means you've just massively enhanced your total compensation package for working parents. You should expect enrollment to jump. It's a huge retention and recruitment tool, and you need to let people know about it way before open enrollment.
And what about the accepted benefit HRA?
A small increase there.
Yeah.
The employer contribution limit moves from $2,150 up to $2,200.
Okay, finally, let's talk retirement savings, 401ks and the like. What's changing there?
The standard employee contribution limit goes up by $1,000, from $23,500 to $24,500.
And what about the catch-up contributions? There are some nuances there now.
There are. The standard catch-up for employees age 50 and over also increases from $7,500 to $8,000. But, and this is a critical detail from the Secure 2.0 Act participants who are ages 60, 61, 62, or 63, have a much higher catch-up limit.
And that number is?
It's $11,250. And that specific limit is actually unchanged from 2025. So your payroll system has to be programmed to handle two different tiers of catch-up contributions.
Good clarification. And last but not least, qualified transportation benefits.
Small increases there. The monthly limits for both transit passes and qualified parking are moving up from $325 to $340 a month. All of these numbers have to get programmed now for a smooth start to 2026.
Excellent. So we've covered immediate compliance for 25 and system updates for 26. Now we'll pivot back one last time to the mandatory paperwork for the coverage you provided last year, ACA reporting.
Right. This reporting is still very much mandatory. It applies to any employer with a self-insured plan and to all ALEs, whether they're fully insured or self-insured.
And they're filing forms 1095 and 1094.
Correct. 1095C and 1094C for ALEs, or the B-series forms for smaller employers with self-insured plans. This is how you document your coverage offers for 2025 to the IRS.
And the deadlines are key here. What are they?
Well, since nearly everyone files electronically now, the threshold is just 10 returns, the electronic filing deadline is March 31st, 2026.
And for the very few who can still file on paper?
Much earlier, March 2, 2026.
Okay, so beyond filing with the IRS, there's the employee notification piece. And this is where the timeline really stretches out, doesn't it?
It does. Employers have to tell employees that their individual statements, the 1095C or B, are available. The standard way to do this is to post a clear notice on your website by March 2, 2026.
But it's not a one-and-done thing. You can't just post it and take it down.
No, and that's the administrative trap. That notice has to stay up on the website continuously all the way through October 15, 2026. And if an employee requests their form, you have 30 days to provide it.
So the admin work for 2025 coverage re-stretches deep into the third quarter of 2026.
That does.
Is there an easier way for ALEs to handle this?
There is. Many just choose to bypass that whole notice and request system. Instead, they just automatically furnish the statements directly to all their employees by the March 2nd deadline.
Which simplifies things a lot.
A lot. It removes the burden of tracking the website notice and handling all those one-off fulfillment requests.
So to wrap up our deep dive, we've really broken down the year-end checklist into two distinct phases. First, you've got the immediate compliance fixes for 2025.
Right. That's the gag clause attestation, finalizing plan documents, and getting that non-discrimination testing done.
And second, there's all the forward-looking system updates for 2026. Programming that new 9.96% ACA affordability rate, analyzing your safe harbors, and of course, implementing all those new benefit limits.
Exactly. The big jump in the dependent care FSA, the new HSA numbers, the retirement plan tiers. By splitting the work this way, you make sure you're legally buttoned up for the year that's ending while you're efficiently preparing for the year to come.
So what does this all mean? The complexity of benefits administration, it's rarely contained within a neat 12-month calendar. The ACA reporting really shows that. The sources highlight that you have to post a notice on your website by March 2nd, 2026, and then keep it up until October 15th. That simple regulatory task connects early spring directly to mid-autumn. It makes you wonder, and this is something to mull over as you work through your own checklist, what other seemingly minor plan requirements, maybe sitting dormant right now, might stretch far beyond the traditional plan year and require your attention in unexpected ways. It's worth taking that wider view of your compliance timelines.